Hello everyone, welcome to Mobile Action Growth Podcast. I'm your host Taha and I'm leading the partnerships at Mobile Action. In this podcast, each episode, we are talking about new mobile growth challenges and ideas with my guest experts who would share their ideas and tips for you to scale your app marketing efforts. And today I'm sitting with one of our agency partners who I believe would share great insights with you, Josh Lloyd, the Managing Director of Envision Media, an app advertising agency, is with me. Hi, Josh. Welcome to the podcast.
Hey, thanks very much for having me. How are you doing?
Sure, doing good. I mean, I'm excited to chat here today. So we have a lot to talk today, but I want to start with, you know, getting to know you and, you know, getting to know the Envision Media as well. So who are you and what does Envision Media offers?
Yeah, thank you very much. Yeah, so I've been in the app industry for 8 years now, I think it is. I'm starting to lose count, but about 8 years working in with mobile apps pretty exclusively. Did a bit of a detour into e-com a few years back, but made my way back through because it's just what I know and what I love. I started Envision Digital back in the March of 2019, so actually quite a still a relatively new company. We're a small company, four or five of us working on the team right now. But I always like to say, I always say to people, we're a small team, but we pack a punch. Let me put my sales cap on for just a second. I'll try not to be too salesy with you though. But so we help, I say, like mobile first, or what is typically a bit more mobile centric businesses grow through performance driven marketing by creating amazing customer experiences and scalable strategies, right? And what that basically means is bringing two elements that we stand for pretty strongly into an app growth program formula, if you will. And that's one of those is being very mindful of how product and marketing work very close or can work closer together, okay? My experience, if there's people out there listening to this podcast who run startups, have run startups, who probably even worked in like corporate businesses with a strong like SaaS or product offering, is that product and marketing can typically sit in the same room. They should sit in the same room as one another, but they sit at opposite ends of the table, so to speak. And CEO will come in and go, hey guys, we need to grow. Like we need to grow X amount in the next like year. And they'll go, yeah, sure, boss. No worries. Not a problem at all. And they'll go their opposite directions with the same goal. And that's great. But if they're not singing from the same hymn sheet, you know, product will go off and do stuff that will have quite a drastic effect on marketing, and marketing will go and do stuff that has quite a drastic effect on product. And the two end up locking heads quite considerably, unless you have someone in the business that is very proactively bringing those two areas together. So we'll go into a bit more detail about that later, about why, how we bring those two things together. But that's just one area to help make those customer experiences really great. And then the second one is enabling businesses to be incredibly user-centric with their data. So we take a lot of pride, we take a lot of effort walking our clients through and actually helping them build the data infrastructure that is necessary to achieve app growth in today's, you know, day and age, especially in the mix of you know, various things within the formula of ASO, organic, paid growth, retention, MCRM, you know, a few other things thrown in there as well. Like we help to try and, I suppose, clear the fog in this kind of quite convoluted, overwhelming industry, and try and make it as clear and as clear and concise for our clients as we possibly can.
Yeah, awesome. So, as you are managing, I believe, lots of paid user acquisition channels for your partners, that is actually the first question that I want to ask, and I'm really curious about. What do you think are the most common misconceptions when it comes to scaling paid user acquisition? Because I frequently hear, you know, oh, we tried that channel, but it didn't work. Oh, we tried to, you know, scale that budget, but somehow, you know, this didn't end up well for us. Why do you think those things happen? And, you know, can you give us some common excuses that you hear all the time?
Yeah, it's a great question, and I hear this in various different forms, like the answer or that kind of typical use case that you just mentioned there. I'm going to start off by saying, like, gone are the days really when you can fire up Facebook Ad Manager, upload a bit of creative and a bit of copy, and target 5 million people wherever, you know, wherever in the world, and it will just work. you know, it was incredibly prevalent for the kind of, I suppose, uprising of dropshipping a few years ago. And I think almost that industry and the e-com industry had forced Facebook to make quite a drastic change with their algorithms. And I think Google as well. I think, you know, it's not just Facebook, but I think there's quite a bit of a change that happened there as a result of all of this media spend going on and buying and the increase and influx of ads that were out on the network. And it just worked brilliantly. It was a great platform. So gone are the days of that. You really need to dive into your strategy in quite a granular way now. Now, misconceptions are typically around that. You know, Josh, if we go and spend £5,000 on Facebook, we should get 5,000 users. That kind of thing, which is, you know, right, put the brakes on. Let's have a think about this, because there's so many different elements that you need to consider. Creative is probably the most important part of any paid media campaign now. How you attract, acquire, you know, really hook the user in. We put a lot of emphasis on understanding the problems of the target audience, and then actually matching those kind of problems with actually how are they consuming content across multiple different platforms. If their problems are typically a bit more conversational, you know, Twitter's a fantastic platform, and so on and so forth. You know, if we want to be a bit more creatively visual, then obviously Instagram, something like TikTok for something more, a bit more UGC. So there's loads of things around that, and I think one of the misconceptions is that you know, that stuff is taken for granted, or that stuff is just like known. It's something that there's a one stop shop process out there for, and there really isn't. So that tends to be something that takes a little bit more time to kind of get right, get nailed, and obviously there's a bunch of testing that can go along with that to help you prove those hypotheses and those experiments. So that's typically one of them that we come across. This, like another one, which is quite prevalent, I think, in the industry, is the, you know, you might have been running a campaign for a few months. Let's say you're getting a cost per install of £5, for argument's sake. Doesn't matter what the industry is really at this point. And let's say the client's spending £5,000-£10,000. Let's say it's £10,000, £5 CPI. And they go, okay, great. Look, we've proven it. You know, people are coming to our app. We've got a really like decently sticky app. We're getting what we want out of the users. The whole kind of thing, funnel to funnel, top to funnel end, is kind of like quite well optimized. It's obviously never really should be standing still. But and they go, okay, so we're getting £5 CPI at 10,000. So theoretically, if we 5x'd our budget, we should 5x our user base. Right. And that's quite a difficult calculation to make. It's quite a difficult thing to predict, because I've definitely seen it in the past, and there's been a lot of like people chatting about this, where you know, you spend X amount of money, you increase your budget. Let's talk about Facebook in this instance. You increase your budget, and Facebook doesn't look at that as a, oh great, you need more users. It looks at it as a way to say, oh great, you can spend more money on your users to acquire your users. So they're almost using that budgetary change to say, okay, well, you can now bid more and pay more to acquire a user because you've got more money to spend on them. And you almost look at that as part of the bidding strategy, part of the bidding factor. Instead of going, I want to spend £10,000 and on a bid of £5, you know, the monetary value that you're putting into these platforms definitely makes quite a big impact. So increasing your budget by 5x does not always lead to a 5x increase in users. It will lead to more users, but if it hits that 5x, is probably something to behold and something to kind of like prove, because yeah, these platforms turn around and think, okay, we can up your bids, we can change the algorithm based on what you want to do. Now maybe that £5 bid, if you are bidding, is no longer relevant. If you want to spend £50,000, you now have to bid £7.50 or £8 or something like that to acquire your user. So there's various things in that, you know, there's a whole bunch of granularity in there that you can do. Again, you've got more creative testing, you've got various other elements that you include in there, funnel event optimization for further into the funnel, which will help with that scalability. So I think the misconception there is that it's not as simple as increasing your budget to increase your user base. And I think it goes to saying that if you're going to increase your budget, you need to look at that over a multitude of channels. You know, you can't facilitate an efficient budget anymore really on one channel over a long period of time. You have to diversify. You have to find these additional pockets of people. You know, we all think that social media is the way that everyone's spending their time in. It's true. Social media's got a lot of our attention, but our attention, I think I read something the other day. We spend about 3 to 4 hours a day on average in other apps other than social media. So our attention is elsewhere. This kind of like micro community environment and micro community kind of angle is becoming bigger and bigger and bigger outside of social media. So, you know, our attention is being pulled in multiple different directions as a consumer. And to capture that attention with a larger budget, you need to look elsewhere in order to do it. So there's that as well. So there's loads of different angles you can look at it from.
Got it. Yeah. I mean, as you mentioned, I think it's really important to, you know, analyze the data that you see all across your user acquisition funnels. But, you know, to do that, you actually have to have your own data, and which leads to my actual next question. I'm really eager to learn what the past data is and, you know, how people can actually apply that. I think it's really new term, and I'm, you know, not that knowledgeable, but I think you have, you know, great knowledgeable about that.
Yeah, fast data. Fast data is a really interesting concept that I've been working on quite a lot over the last few months, including bringing in a lot of our partners into having those kinds of conversations, especially data-driven partners like Mixpanel and Amplitude and Segment, mParticle, those kinds of elements to help understand how businesses, especially startups and scale-ups, also enterprise level who are going through data transformation, how fast data is applicable to them. It's something I've been working on for the last couple of years and kind of diving into how a tech stack can really benefit a company, especially a young company now, not just now, but well into the future. So let me tell you a bit about fast data. So fast data is basically the concept or the methodology that a company can have almost like a business intelligence, like BI level data in a matter of months instead of a matter of years. Now, it very much depends on the business and the model that business is operating on. And when I say business intelligence model, you know, often that operates at like hundreds, if not thousands or millions of data points a second or minute, an hour, whatever that might be, right? It's a vast amount of data that needs to be collected server side, basically crunched and then basically tabulated and formed to create a good amount of analysis, right? That takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of effort. It takes a whole team of data scientists, essentially. Or typically, and it doesn't just happen overnight. It takes years to kind of get to that point. You think about the level of data that Amazon crunches on a daily basis versus what it was when Jeff first started it out of an office selling books from, you know, the local bookstore across the road, which is just acting as the middleman. Like, the level of data there is vastly different to what it is now. Now, fast data, yeah, the application of that kind of strong, accurate data about your users, about your product, about your marketing, all in one place in a matter of, again, a matter of months instead of over a matter of years. Now, the application of that very much comes from the stack and the infrastructure in which you put in place. And I don't want to get into a point where there's a misconception about this kind of terminology of the word fast data, because sometimes especially if we look back in our lifetimes and have a look at various different industries that have adopted or have evolved into this fast industry, we don't want to associate any negative connotations with the word fast. It's not fast and loose. It's not fast and inaccurate. It's a matter of getting it in quickly. Now, yeah, you know, we spoke about this before. You know, if we look at the fast food industry, for example, 10 years ago, we would have gone, yeah, it's great and it's really nice and it tastes good and it's cost effective, it's cheap and all that, but it's not very healthy for us. Therefore, we don't eat it a lot. It's a treat kind of thing. But over the years, that misconception or that conception, however you want to look at it, has been very much changed, like turned on its head. It's gone from being quite a strong negative to maybe a bit of a stronger positive with campaigns that have been created, education around the fact that the meat and everything like that is sourced to a high quality. And it's generally changed the way that we kind of, I suppose, conceive or like think about that industry, its birth, you know, street food and all that kind of stuff, which is fantastic. what we don't want to happen is that the kind of like fast data movement fall into that kind of, oh, it's fast, it's dirty, it's loose. It's not. It's the complete opposite. It's clean, compliant, very accurate, and it's using all the top in like it's using all the best marketing tools out there for analytics and piping the data through and infrastructure and stuff like that. So it really helps to kind of put that message across in this kind of instance. But the application of fast data is incredible. It's bringing about all of your data points, all of the information that your users create, all of the value that they create and generate within your app or within your products, and creating a single source of truth that means you can act quickly and confidently on specific ways in which you grow your business in a very versatile way. It's a once and done solution as well, which completely removes headache of development work over a number of years. So, we're seeing a lot of positivity coming out of it with the businesses that we run this through, and they are typically, you know, startup businesses who need that kind of data to help them grow. So it's super interesting.
Got it. So what are the actual core tech stack parts when it comes to, you know, if you want to have a reliable fast data infrastructure, how we can do that?
Yeah, great question. And typically within small startup businesses, it's there's fewer tools in the tech stack than there would be at enterprise level. But really, it's a foundation of marketing analytics. So typical mobile attribution. AppsFly, if you guys haven't heard of anything or need to go and have a look at stuff, AppsFly, Adjust, Tune, Kochava, Branch, there's a whole bunch of mobile attribution tools out there on the market. You might hear them called MMPs or mobile measurement platforms, mobile marketing platforms, however you want to talk about that. So that's definitely one of them. It's a huge part of it, especially if you are app first. The second part of it is product analytics. This is huge. Product analytics is probably one of the I've definitely been open. My eyes have definitely been open to the world of product analytics in the last couple of years, and how effective it is to not just see significant milestones in a funnel, which marketing analytics would typically deliver, install, registration, purchase, but looking at everything that happens in between. This is where product analytics come into play, because you're not just looking at those significant funnel points. How many people have I got in the top of my funnel versus the bottom? How many people are actually in between those final points? How many people are kind of deviating away from that linear path, what we expect them to do and what we want them to do?
Things like, you know, pushing that button, you know, going to that section, things like that.
Yeah, screen views, page views, interacting with a help section, interacting with certain elements of the app or the product, which don't necessarily fall as part of your KPIs. Mm-hmm. But they do full part of your KPIs. We want to get, let's say the KPIs, we want to have 100 purchases a month, right? But the actual success and the growth and the scalability comes from understanding and knowing, like with certainty, how people get to that point of purchase. Because, and at that point, and only at that point, it's replicable. And that's where there's a lot of work that goes on in the background. You've got various A/B testing that you can do. You've got various hypothesis setting you can do. But this element of like fast data brings about that certainty, brings about that data, which then goes, okay, there's friction here, so we need to fix that. Or, you know, we've got 20 things on our shelf that we can build in terms of new features. And instead of going, eeny, meeny, miny, mo, let's pick one and roll it out, actually you can determine based on your data with this fast data stuff that, oh, we need to build that feature because that's the thing that users are crying out for. This is the thing that's going to help them with their journey. This is the thing that's going to get them to the point of purchase. And so on and so forth. So product analytics is huge. So that's just the two elements, product marketing and product analytics. A third one, customer engagement. So you might work with a company like Braze, an Iterable, a Leanplum, a customer.io, an Airship, a OneSignal, whatever those elements are to help automate your communication to your users. It's all about engagement, activation, nurture, and retention. To help build those relationships, and also it incredibly helps with personalization as well. Again, that constant feed of data through fast data tech stack, it means you're constantly getting those data points on your users, which means you can actually almost have a pretty much a one-on-one relationship with them, depending on the volume of your data as well. That's kind of like what I would class as the basics. Now that is all basically fed in via a CDP, customer data platform, Segment, mParticle, Bloomreach, to name a few. which enables the data to be once and done. It enables it to be scalable with the various different points of your tech stack. It means that your data is compliant and clean from the moment that you implement it into your product as well. So those kind of like four areas are really, really key. And then the bigger you get, the more versatile you can get with your tech stack. That might be the introduction of an additional CRM platform. It might be various like S3 buckets or server buckets to help you understand and analyze your data even further. And that's then going into like the business intelligence level. Customer support, Zendesk, you know, all of these things are kind of attached onto a CDP in a matter of minutes, essentially, rather than a matter of weeks or months with development time. So those are like the core elements. And again, like it's very the breadth and width that you can get into it is quite fantastic, really.
Got it. And once you complete that tech stack, what do you think is the best practice to, you know, do these iterations? Is it like, you know, every time you see something that is improvable, just go back to the funnel and change it? Or you recommend, you know, just analyze the users based on, you know, month over month and see, you know, how that changed and do iterations based on, you know, historic events?
Yeah, it's a good question. Now, there is still an element of like statistical significance when it comes to this stuff, right? You can't, like, if you've got 100 people and 98 people just aren't completing your funnel, you could have a good understanding as to why that is. You might see some friction. It could be a particular device type. But I think some of the time, maybe more the majority of the time, it's something that requires a lot more understanding. And that could be from an emotional sense. Now, product managers and product people will talk about these user stories. How do you get from... I was actually doing some work on that recently. How do you understand the emotion of a user, which means that they use your app? How do you then understand the actions? And then what are the emotions of that user thereafter? And it's almost like you almost want this. What's the emotion at the top? And then the action, emotion, action, emotion, action, emotion, until they get to the end of your funnel, or, you know, they're just constantly in this viral loop within your app, which is what your app is built off of. Maybe it's a subscription or, you know, whatever that might be. So until you understand the action and the emotion of your users, it can be, you can still be going that kind of fly by day, fly by night kind of, let's swap this in, let's do that, let's do this, and see if it either improves or breaks the system. A lot of people don't mind the whole let's move quickly and break things. It's the Zuckerberg like influence, right? It's the move fast and break things thing, which means that you get to a point of understanding who your users are, what you need to do with your product. But a lot of companies don't have the luxury of that, and to be perfectly honest with you, it's a bit of a mindset game. A lot of people don't have the mindset to appreciate what that does for a company. So it's understanding how you introduce those various different elements. I kind of digress a little bit, but what I would recommend as part of understanding how to utilize that tech stack, what to build into your app, and to help those kind of marketing elements is, gaining that statistical significance where you could be confident through your data that you have got the right information to go something's wrong, right? Mm-hmm. If you wake up in the morning and go, is something wrong with my app, and you're not sure, look at your data. You should never. I think that's the better question. Not, oh, my app's brilliant. That what's right with my app? No, what's mm-hmm. wrong with my app? Because then you'll start focusing on the areas that are going to help improvements. And then you've got to understand, why is it wrong? How is it wrong? How often is it being wrong? And why do people find it like that? It's wrong. And this is where you then need to understand the difference between qualitative and quantitative data, where there's a bunch of numbers on the screen that can tell you that your conversion rates are dipping at a certain point in your funnel and that there's an issue there, but it won't tell you necessarily why people feel the need to churn or drop off from that particular point. Some stuff are replicable. Oh, it crashed. Oh, it doesn't quite work on this device ID, or there's something missing, or it doesn't scroll properly. You know, there's technical problems, and then there's the emotional problem of it. Why didn't you finish our onboarding platform? It was too long. It was arduous. I got bored. Didn't want to do it. I moved on somewhere else. There's another app that has a processor that's half the amount of time it takes, mm-hmm. right? That's a very emotive response. So you've understand the emotion to get them into your app. they're doing action within your app, but the emotive response is causing them to go elsewhere or drop off or be quite a bit like frustrated with the process. And that comes from a really interesting point of micro surveying, which you can still implement as part of this tech stack and this fast data movement. But it's understanding one-on-one how your users are emoting around your product. And I've realized in the last, like even the last 6 to 9 months, that is probably like it brings such a level of power to your product and to you as a founder or as a marketing manager or as a product manager. That, and again, you know, this is something that goes across the board. This is not just something that a product manager wants to see or a marketing manager wants to see. It's something that they both should be seeing. And this is the whole thing about bringing them together. Because if they can both analyze that data and product goes, we're going to implement micro surveying because marketing said, oh, there's a dip in our conversion funnel here. They're working together and then they can come to that conclusion, right, something's wrong with this. And then it goes, then marketing has the empowerment to go, our cost per registration is £10. It's okay. It's not the best. We want it to be less. Mm-hmm. Product then go, oh, right, let's change the onboarding funnel. Let's, you know, let's see if we can change that conversion rate from 50 to 65%. All of a sudden, marketing's cost metrics are improving by 15%. So you've got that, you're now acquiring more users. It's cheaper. It's more scalable. It's more efficient for your business. So you see, I hope that kind of makes sense. And I kind of did that in a way that kind of followed on with a bit of a journey there. Cause I feel like I just brain dumped massively in those last few minutes. But, does that make sense from your perspective there?
Yeah, it's perfectly, you know, aligned with what I think is, I think of the apps as a, like a physical store. And, you know, most of people think that, you know, it's the more users you bring into your shop, it's more likely to, you know, get more purchases and do more revenue. But, you know, when it comes to doing that optimization, you know, along the how you're communicating with the customers that are coming into the store, you know, how is your products are placed, and, you know, well, how's the checkout process like? And, you know, if you don't, you know, think about the each section very well, at the end of the day, you know, this optimization feedbacks to the actual user acquisition costs.
Yeah.
So the more you focus on your funnel, the better and the cheaper relatively you acquire users, right?
Yeah. It's a really interesting point that you make there, because if you consider the app store and your app in a more brick and mortar fashion, you'll walk down the high street or you'll walk down a shopping center, whatever that might be, and you'll have these various different like outlets or things in front of you. That is like the app store. You're walking exactly. Through, you're trying to pick out the app or the clothes or the place that you want to go buy your clothes, right? And what you'll notice is over a period of time, the shop window changes. Seasonally, new collections, depending if they're very female or male orientated, if they're kid orientated, like they'll start implementing these various different ways to entice you into their store. If they don't get that right, you are not attracted enough to go in and, you know, actually shop with them and actually purchase an item. There's various different people that do that. And it's the same with the app store. You change that. And we spoke about it on the webinar the other week with you guys, that, you know, there's these CPPs, like custom product pages, that are coming out via Apple now, native A/B testing, those kinds of elements. You know, shop brick and mortar stores already do that native A/B testing. It's called, you know, having a shop manager come in and dress up mannequins, right? It's the same thing. And then it's a matter of, you then got almost like two people. There's people that go in there with intent, and there's like, you might have done this as well. You might go past the shop and go, I really like that shirt. I want to go buy that shirt. And you'll go into the shop, you'll try it on, you'll and ah about it, and you'll be like, you'll look at the price tag a few times and you'll go, oh, you know what? It's worth the £40. Take it off and you'll go and buy it. And then there are other people that will go in, have a bit of a flick through because they're like, oh, I kind of like that style. And they'll go through and they'll have a bit of a flick through the clothes and they might try something on. And they might go, you know what? No, another day. And then they'll leave and they'll go back. It's the same. It's the very much the same concept. It's, you know, this is why then retail then developed into people on the shop floor. Hey, is there anything I can do for you today? Like, have you found everything that you want? That element of it there, have you found something you like? Can I help you find anything? Is what we implement via like push and email marketing, like marketing automation, mm-hmm. That nurturing, that one-on-one. It's the education, it's the awareness, it's the, hey, look, we noticed that you've done this, but you haven't done that. How do we help you get from A to B? And that's from a marketing and from a product perspective, because it's just, yeah, it's the same. It's crazy. Like, it's because if there was one type of shirt or one type of dress that could convert everyone to buying it, mm-hmm. it would exist. Like, there are typically that, but they come in various different shapes, lengths, sizes, colors, all those kinds of things to help optimize that journey to then get that point to the point of purchase. So very, very similar offline and online, kind of, you know, basically the same technique, just in various different forms.
Definitely. And you don't, you know, have as, you know, little time as the physical store has when it comes to, you know, engaging with a user. When a user comes to your app and, you know, submits their information or email, at that point on, you know, you can try to, you know, engage with them in a matter of weeks, months, and eventually yeah. they may be interested or not, but you have this time frame. So you have the time to analyze the data as well. So yeah, it's really good to do follow-up optimization. But yeah. at the end of the day, I think it all comes down to, you know, you can do all the, you know, the most optimized funnel, but if you don't acquire a good volume of users, it's always, you know, going to be not enough in terms of, you know, revenue perspective when it comes yeah. to app businesses, because, you know, acquiring users is, I believe, is, you know, 70-80% of the job when it comes to, you know, the revenue perspective. And the other part is, you know, equally important as well. So when it comes to acquiring users, I believe, you know, the paid channels drives most of the users to today's non-gaming apps. And I believe you have some insights about this, you know, acquisition costs in terms of, you know, the channel performances. And since, you know, lots of things changed in the past couple months in mobile marketing, how do you yeah. see this, you know, CPR performances now, let's say compared to, you know, a couple years ago?
It's changed quite drastically. And I think that comes with the adoption of and the kind of publishing of hundreds of thousands, if not millions more apps into the app stores. The emphasis has come has definitely changed based on the usage of mobile devices as well. You know, I'm very much of this mindset, and I'm kind of gearing up for this change where we saw the shift from desktop to mobile web happen quite dramatically. When was that, like 6 years ago now? Where are we, 2021? Let's say 7-8 years ago, over that time. I think we're going to see that shift from mobile web and just traffic on desktop and mobile web shift to mobile quite significantly. I think that people are finding these new ways of communicating with their users, of collecting their users in one place. And I think that also comes from a fact that Facebook and these social medias companies actually make it very difficult for you to hit an organic kind of portion of your user base, right? You know, I think it was a number of years ago, organically on Facebook, you could generate 10,000 people as part of your to like your page, but you would only ever hit, like, I think it was like 6-8% of them on a monthly basis. And that, I think that even dropped even further below 5%. But you know, you put all this effort in to collect people and to acquire friendly faces and to try and build relationships with people, and they make it incredibly difficult to do so. This is why I think this whole kind of micro community thing is becoming such a big element and a big aspect of what apps are trying to achieve these days. And it's drawing people in multiple different directions at the same time, so their attention is very much pulled in some instances away from social media into these different environments. And so that comes with a cost. It comes with quite a significant change. And as I kind of mentioned earlier, you know, gone are the days of just, you know, turning on Facebook and hitting your expected CPIs or hitting, you know, actually really cost efficient CPIs. You have to work for it. And it comes as a matter of changing your creatives, changing your messaging, and being able to be relevant to certain pockets of people in the world. There's, you know, I've got this thing, and I talk about it with clients quite a lot in the early stages of working with them. And it's, if you talk to too many people, you basically talk to no one at all. And the element of that basically comes from, there's not one problem that my market share potential of like a million people, 1 million people do not share the same problem. Be nice if they did, but typically, you know, they could have similar problems, and there might be a few elements that change: environmental, sociologically, psychologically. You know, there are very different like levels and stuff to that. So, you know, I think that's where a lot of this kind of like change has been made in algorithms and the way that that affects our CPIs and CPAs is that, you know, if you find yourself talking to too many people at once and being a bit too broad and generalistic, you'll typically find your CPIs to go up. If you become very relevant and kind of a bit more niche, but to a large-ish audience, and say large-ish, like you probably want to be trying to hit about 1 million to 1.5 million people with your targeting, but speak very much to individual problems. Don't worry about if it's not relevant to some of them, but you want to hit the people that are relevant. You want them to act quickly. You want them to take that action that you're desiring them to do. And so by doing that, you'll see your CPIs stabilize in a way that is cost efficient for what you want to do and hits that point of scalability. So, you know, it's increasingly difficult for companies, businesses, like product-led businesses to sometimes think in this way. You know, we're all trying to wear multiple different hats at the same time. And this marketing element, this element of getting that CPI and getting those strategies right is a full-time job. Like, it requires specialists, it requires full-time dedication into just that one element to get right. And so you typically will find that you'll miss the mark if you don't approach those things too well. But it's ever changing, right? It's ever fluctuating, and I don't think it will ever like stabilize. But the way you can stabilize that is diversifying your marketing mix and the channels that you use, and being, you know, with the privacy issue, the changes that have happened. I say issues coming from a marketer head, but the privacy changes that have happened. You know, you've got to be a bit more relaxed, I think, in terms of what you might expect from these channels.
Yeah, I mean, as for the user acquisition, I want to go back to the physical store and online store analogy. And actually, you know, acquiring users via intent ad platforms versus non-intent platforms like Facebook and other, you know, in-app platforms are kind of like different, just because if you imagine in the physical world, when you're in a shopping mall, just browsing through a couple shops, and as for, you know, if you were to compare it to the Facebook, you see an ad at the, you know, somewhere in the shopping mall, and you could be interested in the service of this company. But for intent platforms, like, you know, let's say Google or Apple search ads, people are searching for the exact thing that you're offering. And I think it really changes, you know, in terms of the performance and also the retention wise. So I'm wondering about your thoughts about actually, you know, this intent platforms like Google and Apple search ads in, you know, these times of the user acquisition.
My thoughts around them and how much of an emphasis they play on marketing mixes, that kind of thing.
Yes.
Yeah, it's an interesting question, and we look at it in a few different ways. So there's a couple of things that you really need to take into consideration as a business owner, as a marketing manager, product manager, whatever it is that your business is made up of, before you start spending that money. Apple search ads, typically there's a best practice around hierarchy of campaigns. You know, looking at branded versus non-branded keywords. Industry, more generic keywords, maybe competitor keywords, broad exact match, those kinds of elements to help you target the right users. Now, there's this big thing in ASO, especially for the iOS store. You know, the description doesn't play a part in the natural algorithmic ranking of your app, which is true. It is titles, it is the metadata and your keywords in the back end, but the keywords and the way that you form your description very much has an impact on Apple search ads and the way that kind of element works. Now, within Apple search ads, you can do this thing called search match, which basically you allow the algorithm to choose keywords or to bid on keywords based on user behavior and search terms. There is something to be said around the fact that it will take into consideration the keywords and the phrasing that you have within your description to allow that to be more relevant for you. So what I'm getting at is that it's very difficult just to turn these things on again. It's just very difficult to turn these things on and expect a whole bunch of good performance to come in. You have to be prepared, and you have to be prepared before you turn it on. You have to be prepared to make quick changes and optimizations in order to improve that performance. I look at Apple Search Ads and maybe like Google UAC as a big part of anyone's channel marketing mix. Budgets dependent to a certain degree. But there's so much that you can do with that data and understanding that kind of more intent-based marketing. Again, it comes down to, from my perspective, understanding who your users are, the problems they're going through. You really have to, I try and step into our clients' customers' shoes as much as possible, interacting with the apps on a regular basis, thinking about the different ways in which people would search for these kinds of apps and the terminology they're using. You know, there's a huge part to play in it with something like mobile action, and to understand those keywords and those trends and to help you do that kind of analysis. I think you have to move very quickly in any kind of digital marketing space nowadays, but I think with those especially, you have to move very quickly and have a scope planned out, which is, you know, operating 2, 3, if not 4 or 5 steps ahead of where you are when you're standing still. You have to be thinking about what does this week entail, but what do the following weeks entail? And that's something that we've done. We've built up a process which enables us to look at those, look at not just now and how we set it up now and run it tomorrow, but how we run it in a month's time. It's almost a if this, then that kind of situation. And it's not, you know, it's not the same across, it's not a one size fits all, but it's a, you know, if this happens, then we need to do this, or we should look at that, or, you know, in it, there's just so many different forks in the road in being able to analyze and understand how that data and how that information is applicable to you as a company. So I love them. I think they're great platforms, but yeah, there's a lot to think about with them.
All right. So I've been thinking, you know, we both are in the mobile world, and we are always, you know, analyzing the market, seeing, you know, new apps coming up to the app store, and, you know, always seeing, you know, new experiments going on. But I want to ask you, you know, if you were to build an app today, a non-gaming app, in which category you would focus in, in which niche you would focus on, you know, in terms of, you know, interest and revenue-wise, and also, you know, the kind of problems that you want to solve.
Yeah, it's something that I think about quite a lot. I'm constantly got these app ideas. I'm like, oh, I wonder if anyone's done that. Oh, I wonder if that's a thing. I've probably got a list the length of my forearm over the last few years, which some of them probably wouldn't even be relevant to this day, or I have actually seen similar kind of things come to the market. I don't know what industry or what genre I'd operate in. I mean, fintech. I love the fintech industry, but I think we're getting to a point now where people are struggling to find differentiating factors to help their users. I think it's becoming a little bit, it can be quite convoluted, especially in like the banking space. You know, it's getting a little bit convoluted. You know, it's the same things on, you know, lower interest on Forex exchanges or whatever that might be. But, you know, the difference is like 0.01% between company A and company B. Like it operates in the same sphere. I love the industry. I think there's a lot of revenue, there's a lot of opportunity to be grabbed at and maximizing that. Where would I think, actually, you know what, based on recent experiences and some searches I've been making recently, I think like the mental well-being space is actually a massive part of that. And I don't mean it from a, you know, there's various different subsets of the journaling, maybe like chatting, meditation. I'm big. I love that kind of stuff. I use Calm on a regular basis, like, or every night. Every night I'm listening to sleep stories. I actually looked at my stats yesterday, about 165 hours or something like that of, you know, of sleep meditation and sleep stories that I've had over the last few months. So it's like I'm an avid user. I believe in it fully, and I think it really helps me and my mindset. I'm talking more along in the almost like professional help sector. That's fine. I think, and I kind of liken this to going to the gym. I don't mind going to the gym, but my self-motivation in the gym is like minimal compared to if I had a personal trainer. But do I want to pay for a personal trainer to show me how to use a treadmill? Probably not, but it's, I know it's more than that, by the way, but you know, it's, that's what my, the way my mind goes. And so I'm a massive advocate of things like Calm and Headspace, etc. But there is an element of how do I do better? How do I better myself? And it's not maybe a motivational thing. It's maybe a lack of information or lack of understanding thing. You know, I'm really interested in the psychology of people, and especially around when it comes to like buyer psychology and consumer psychology. But it's just something I struggle to wrap my head around. Anyway, I think, yeah, I've actually been looking at quite a few apps recently to help me kind of maintain my mental health and maintain the way that I view myself and the way that I view my business and the world, essentially. Expensive. I know counseling is expensive, but in a digital format, it's expensive. I just want someone to regularly check in with and to someone to be a bit profound with me, or maybe in a bit more of a coaching sense, but and just be profound with me and kind of challenge the way that I think about things. Do I think that's worth £200-300 a month? Maybe not. I don't know, at the moment, probably because I can't afford to spend that amount of money on that kind of service. I think there's something there where there is a professional body, a professional available that can help you, even if it's just a quick video conversation that is, I can't get my head out of this this anxiety kind of situation that I've got myself into. And for them to spend half an hour just slightly unpicking it. When did it start? How did you get to that point? Like, what does that stem into? Have you thought about doing this? What about that? And actually just, I think it's just more direction. Because I think you can very much do the scattergun approach of, there's so many different apps out there on the marketplace. And I'm just going to go and use them all until I find one that works. I kind of want someone to be there going, okay, so you've got X, Y, and Z issues. We'll call them issues. And this is what we would recommend as a solution. And, you know, you can go away. I can go in, know that I'm doing the right thing, much like a PT would go, PT, I want to lose X amount of weight and I want to reduce my body fat, my BMI. Okay, great. We're going to do half an hour session a week and you're going to do X, Y, Z. And in 4 weeks time, you're going to see a reduction in BMI and a reduction of weight and maybe a bit, you know, you might actually see those abs come through. Oh, great. I've told them my problem. They've devised a plan and we're going to get to that solution. We're going to get to that kind of end goal and objective. And from there, I can then choose what I want to do next. Oh, now Mr. PT or Mrs. PT, I want to bulk up a little bit on my upper half, or I don't know what to do with my legs. And then do you see what I mean? Like, it's that kind of, I don't know what to do with this part of my brain or this part of my brain or this kind of emotion. And yeah, I feel like there's a lot in there. What would I do very quickly? Because I know I've been rambling on. What would I do with that? Right. I would build out my brand. I would make it very identifiable. And I would very much focus on who my target audience are and how I speak to them. Like 100%. I don't really mind if it's just 1% of a population or if it's 0.01% of a population. I know that there's a population there. Focusing on the problems. Actually talk to people who you think will have similar problems. Get that kind of confidence in that what you're talking about and the problems you want to solve are actually going to be solvable. Test creative, like 7 ways to Sunday. It's something that should never stand still, but test creatives, test the way that you're going to attract in your audience on a small spend to begin with, and learn a bit about how you can hit that scalability. Build in a tech stack that is going to benefit you now and well into the future from in a very cost-effective manner, and implement that fast data methodology that we spoke about earlier. And then be constantly iterating on that product analytics, constantly developing your ideas and constantly adding value. That's where I think a lot of businesses can typically fall down, is you're adding value in your app, but what other additional value are you bringing to that user? And I'm going to go back to the fast food thing, to the probably one of the biggest franchises. You know, they sell, they started off by selling burgers, right? And I think you can go and Google this. Is quite a fascinating and an accurate kind of analogy. They started selling burgers for whatever it was, but they realized that they wanted to improve their profit margins. They wanted to increase the way that they made money. So it's not, yeah, they create burgers, they make burgers for the general public, but then they offer fries. And then they start offering milkshakes and drinks on top of it. So that's the added value because they're a burger joint. But, and you can go and just buy a burger or nuggets or whatever you want from that. But the added value is, and you can also buy this and you can also buy that. Now, I'm not necessarily saying that it'll be like a subscription, then users can buy these multiple things, give it away for free, you know, or have different tiering models within your subscription which enables that additional value. So you want to achieve this in your mental health. Well, try, you know, do this or join that or, you know, or join this webinar, very much like how podcasts are very, you know, drive a lot of value, how webinars drive a lot of value. Consistently be iterating on that value to your end customer, because that's going to promote the stickiness that you need to be successful.
Got it. I pretty much like your idea, but I think, you know, the reason that we haven't seen that much innovation in the, you know, mental fitness area is I think the demand, just because, like, you know, the physical fitness is pretty mainstream and, you know, everybody wants to get the, you know, build up their muscles and, you know, get shredded if they want. Yep. But nobody wants to get, you know, I believe a good volume of people in the world that is really, you know, want to take care of their mental fitness. But it's not as much as the, you know, the population that wants to. Yeah,
it's true. If you stood up in front of a group of, let's say, a significant amount of people, 10,000 people, and went, right, put your hand up if you want to achieve a mental six pack.
Nah, I'm going to pass, right?
Put your hand up if you want to achieve a six pack on your body. A good portion of people are going to be like, yeah, I could quite like that. And that the motivation and the work is an additional thing. But yeah, I'm the same. I don't have a six pack. If someone asked me, would I want one? I'd be like, yeah, that'd be pretty good.
Yeah.
That would be pretty cool, you know? So you're right. I think there is that element of, unless you educate, if you want to go, if I wanted to go down the route of saying, you know, improve your mental fitness, get a mental six pack.
Uh-huh.
I'd have to go through a lot of work to educate my users about what that mental six pack is so that they start using it in their terminology. It's the same thing, and it's understanding the problems. You have these problems. My solution, my process, like my actual process that I've built is building a mental six pack. Yeah. And the mental six pack program consists of A, B, C, D, E, F, G. And then people start to understand what it is. And then they start going, oh yeah, I'm going to join that mental six pack program because it's, you know, it does all the things that I want it to do. Right. So, you're completely right. You need to hit the right terminology. You need to be able to educate your users on what it is. And this is why, I mean, this fast data movement stuff is what I've got a lot of work to do in that area, because you say fast data and everyone's like, well, speedy information, like, what is it? And you've got to educate people around what it makes up and what the intricacies of it are. Otherwise it just falls flat on its face.
Definitely. I mean, because you need to educate your audience, because most of the time people comes down to a solution or an app to solve a problem. But when it comes to, you know, attributing to the problem of, you know, what it caused, it's really, you know, hard to understand, you know, where to attribute that problem and how you can find a solution. Most people, you know, may find it in the physical fitness, but some problems maybe they are facing is not, you know, the answer of solving that problems are may not be, you know, physical, but mental. But I think it's, you know, really takes time for a good volume of people to, you know, understand which is, you know, right attribution to their problem. Yeah. But yeah, I really think the way of saying, you know, educating your audience in terms of, you know, having them, being them, making them able to understand if they're your, you know, target audience or not.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a big element. It's a really big element, and I think it comes down to within any business, it's a process driven element. These are the problems. This is the process in which we help. We've defined for our users. It's, you know, it's proven. It's effective. It's cost efficient. It's, you know, all of these things. You do then have to go through an element of proving that with your users. And I've got a saying that I do kind of have on my desk. It's kind of like under a couple of letters at the moment, but I had it on my desk very prominently for a long period of time. And it's focus on the process and the results will look after themselves. If you focus too much on the results, they won't come. And I think for me, it was quite profound. I used to tell myself it like a few times a day. I used to read it. I used to stare at it. I still regularly remind myself about it when I feel like I'm too focused on the result and just feel less confident on whatever process it is. I have to really take a step back and go, right, what's the process? How do we make it even more airtight? How do we even like improve upon it? And it's the same with any business. You know, the process is your app funnel. The process is the service that you deliver. Focus on the process. Talk to the right people. I'm going to add that in there. Talk to the right people and the results, they will look after themselves. If you focus way too hard on the results without the process, they won't come, or they will, but in a very mediocre way. And in a way that isn't scalable. So I'd always, yeah, anyone who is still listening, I'd definitely kind of implement that into your business as much as you possibly can.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you can control the process, but you cannot control the results most of the time, right? Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Josh, thanks so much for joining me today. I mean, it was a great chat and I appreciate you sharing the words here.
No, thank you very much for inviting me on. It's been a pleasure. And yeah, very much like to come back at some point in the future.
Yeah, let's do it. All right. Everyone, this is the end of this podcast episode. And if you have some questions to Josh, you can reach him out at josh@envisiondigital.media. It is josh@envisiondigital.media. And if you like this episode, you can listen to previous ones from, you know, wherever you are listening to your podcast. And yes, thanks for listening. Talk to you on the next episode. Mm-hmm.